Hey everybody, here we go with looking at soil, as promised from the last lecture, and we are going to be talking about some of the other items on this page as well in future lectures, including groundwater and the magmatic metamorphic processes. Groundwater is one that does come up in the reading, as does soil. So we're going to start with soil, and then again in a future lecture, I'll talk about groundwater. But it is part of this week's module. Okay, so let's take a look here and see where we're at. Does anybody recognize where this picture is from? This is in Oregon. I don't know, some of you may have been out there before. If you haven't, I would highly recommend checking it out. It is the Painted Hills. And they're called painted because they look like they were painted, right? You've got all these stripes here. This is actually stratigraphy, okay? And when I say stratigraphy, I mean layers of sedimentary rock. It's part of the John Day Formation. So these particular ones are going to be somewhere between 40, probably about 40 million years, maybe 30, between 40 and 30. I don't remember the exact age of this particular member of the John Day Formation, but we're talking, you know, tens of millions of years ago that these things were deposited. And they create this really beautiful outcrop. And this is ultimately clay. Okay, we're going to be talking about clay here as an industrial mineral, find out about its uses and such. But one of the things that's wonderful about clay is that it can weather into really beautiful colors like this. And since you have these layers of rock, right, that are weathering into clay, each layer of rock has its own characteristics, right? And so they come out as different colors. Some of that is because the rock itself that was deposited in that layer is unique. And so from one layer to the next, you may get different unique types and chemistries, which would then express themselves later on in this kind of a weathering pattern as stripes. Some of it could also be due to when weathering was occurring and the changes in climate, right, that are in these recorded, let's say, in these rocks. So when these rocks were deposited, some of these things were soils. And the soil is going to be a function not only of the rock that's weathering, but it's also going to be a function of the climate. And so geologists and paleontologists have looked at these rocks in these soils, ancient soils, in detail and made interpretations about changes in climate over the time that this stuff was deposited. So at the time that this was deposited, again, we're talking, you know, between maybe 30 and 40 million years ago, the interpretation is that Central Oregon, which you can see what it is today, this is kind of the natural scrubland, right? It's relatively arid in Central Oregon. That's the other side of the Cascade Mountains. So the Cascades create a rain shadow, making it arid, high desert. Very different from what we see here in the Willamette Valley, where it's green and whatnot. But so on the other side of the mountains, it's relatively dry, all this scrub plant. And by interpreting both the flora and fauna, okay, so animals and plants coming out of these layers here, some of which contain fossils, people have interpreted, right, the climate at this time in Central Oregon to be more of a temperate kind of woodland forest climate, which is really interesting. Okay, that's different from what it was today, what it is today. So we can see this record of climate change recorded in these rocks. And again, what we're looking at here are clays. Now, these are exposed, right? You don't have plants growing on these things. I wonder why. Does anybody know why that's the case? Well, I'll tell you. It's because clays, when you have certain types of clays at least, clays have the ability to absorb quite a bit of water. Okay, and so when they do, when it does rain out here, it's relatively dry, but it does rain sometimes, these clays will expand as they absorb that water. We're going to look at the structure of clays here in just a moment to help us understand that, but they'll expand out, and then when they dry, because it won't then rain for a while, right, then they dry back out, they desiccate, and then they contract. So they're expanding and contracting. And as that's happening, the soil is just so active and moving so much that plants just don't have a chance to gain root in these soils. So yeah, pretty fascinating. But these are clays. Ultimately, these sort of darker layers are going to be iron-rich kaolinite layers. And then the lighter layers in between are smectites. So both different, just different clay types, different chemical formulas, and they're kind of alternating right through time here. Real beautiful. Again, that's the John Day National Monument. Really cool. Not too far from Portland. Not a lot of people make it out there. It's not as well visited, I think, as a lot of the really cool natural stuff we have in the Pacific Northwest. So highly recommend it. If you haven't been out there, I would suggest you do so. Actually, I'm going to be running a field trip to this area, and I do it every spring to Central Oregon. And it's a one-credit field trip that's open to anybody. And we go out there, we camp for one night, and we look at all these rocks and fossils, and it's really cool. Beautiful area. Okay, so that's one example of clay, right? We have quite a bit in Oregon. It can, you know, serve just the purpose of being beautiful. I mean, that's something that it can do, as well as having all sorts of other uses. So this is kind of interesting, right? This is a map of Oregon here. And in this map, we're looking at different, you know, industrial minerals ultimately that are going to be related to, in many cases, clay. And you know, clay is ultimately just a type of, within the umbrella term of mudstone. Okay, and what's mudstone? Well, it's kind of similar to sandstone in the sense that, you know, you go to the beach, you see a bunch of sand. If that sand is buried, it eventually lithifies together, cements together, and creates a rock. And we just add the word stone to that. So it becomes sandstone, right? Sandstone is derived from sand that's buried and lithified, in other words, cemented together. To create a rock, sandstone. Mudstone is the same thing, okay? Ultimately, you just have mud-sized grains. So these are smaller than sand size. Mud-sized grains that are buried, and eventually they start to lithify together. They cement together, creating a rock, and we call that mudstone, okay? And mudstone ultimately is just grain size. That's all it's referring to. Anything smaller than a sand grain is going to be a mud grain. This is like official nomenclature in geology, right? So mud-sized grains, smaller than sand grains, and then when it comes and lithifies together, it makes a stone, a mudstone. Clay, okay? Claystone, silt, or siltstone, both of those are subgroups within mudstone, okay? They're just different types of mud. So clay is going to be a smaller grain size than silt. So within mudstone, it goes silt is a little bit larger, and then clay is a little bit smaller. Pretty simple. So we have quite a bit of mudstone, shall we say, throughout Oregon. You know, this stuff is, we're going to look at how it's deposited at some point here, but this map is showing where you get some of these clays, right? Bentonite. Okay, we're going to look at that, which is right here, Central Oregon bentonite. Diatomite, we're going to look at that as well. And you can see brick. I mean, brick is ultimately going to be made out of mud. It's mudstone. You know, even some volcanic sort of products, you know, these can be quite variable. Actually, quartz, limestone, more brick, etc. So there's, you know, soapstone way down here. So we have all sorts of interesting kind of industrial mineral mines throughout Oregon, and we're going to look at a couple of these, okay? We're going to look at a couple. We're going to actually cruise over to Teague Mineral Products in the course of this lecture here. Okay, so one of the things we just saw was diatomite. What is diatomite? Well, it is a type of, it's siliceous. So diatoms, it's made of these little organisms, right, which are called diatoms. So diatomite is a sedimentary rock, ultimately. It's composed of all these little shells. And in the case of diatoms, they're made out of silica. Okay, most of the shells that you might run into, whether it's in rocks or whether it's on the beach, you know, if you go to the Caribbean, you're going to be looking at beaches, white sand beaches. A lot of those things are covered in little shell fragments, right? Those shells are not generally made out of silica. Those shells are made out of carbonate. Okay, it's the same stuff that creates limestone. This is a little different. These are silica-based shells. So there are organisms out there that make their homes ultimately out of silica shells as opposed to carbonate shells, the stuff that goes into limestone. And why are they doing that? Well, we have a lot of this in Oregon, and the reason is because we have volcanoes. And what are those volcanoes doing? Well, those volcanoes are spewing ash into the air, okay? And it just so happens that ash ends up being very silica rich, okay? And that ash, in some cases, is falling into lakes, potentially. You know, if you go back in time far enough, it could even be falling into sort of an inland sea or a marine environment. But regardless, I'd say since the Cascades have been around, at least, and they've been erupting, et cetera, we're really talking about lakes, probably internally drained lakes, like lakes that don't have an outlet in many cases. And so anyway, in those lakes, you have ash that falls, and it falls on the lakes just like it does over the landscape. And some of that ash ends up dissolving in the lake water, and that's ends up being dissolved silica. Well, who likes those? Diatoms love that type of environment. And if they're in lake water that's got a lot of dissolved silica, they're going to be really happy because they got all this material, this raw material, silica, in order to make their homes with. So so in certain lakes where you have diatoms, you know, that may have been really active and abundant in the past, those diatoms are creating these shells. And then when they die, what happens? Well, those shells, all the suspension settle down to the bottom of the lake, and that gets preserved. Right, as additional material gets buries it and is deposited on top, eventually that stuff gets preserved and then maybe gets exposed back up at the surface when a river comes through and erodes the surrounding material and exposes maybe some layers of ultimately lake deposits that have a lot of diatoms in them. Right, so that would be diatomite. That's a, you know, it's a very legitimate product. And this stuff is mud size. It's very small grain. But if you go, you get a microscope out, this is what you'll see. Okay, so when we talk about mudstone, a lot of times you see it sort of existing in these sort of flaky, layered, texture, if you will. And this is a very high magnification image, right, coming from what's called an SEM, a scanning electron microscope. So this is getting you in very, very close, very high resolution. You can see this is 5 microns that's going across here from there to there, right? And that is a very small distance. So we have these sort of layers that you can see here, and this is very typical of clay. Okay, clay ends up making this, it has this sort of layered texture to it. And why does it do that? Well, let's go on to the next. You can see what happens here. This is going to be this diagram, in my mind, is important for a lot of reasons, and we'll probably come back to it later in the class. But I was talking about 2 different types of material here. We were talking about sand. We've mentioned that a couple times now, and then shale, which is ultimately mud. Okay, anything smaller grain than sand, shale would be a rock, right? That's created out of mud, like a mudstone. It's a type of mudstone. Okay, so the grains of these two are different, right? The grains of the mud are going to be elongate, kind of like this. Okay, well, sand grains are much more spherical. They might not be perfect spheres, but they're going to be more spherical. And what happens is these grains are deposited. It could be in a floodplain, right? Floodplains end up being muddy. It could be out in a delta, right? You get out beyond a delta, it gets muddy out there in the continental shelf. I'm in the marine environment. You can get these things deposited all over the place. And when these are deposited, you can see there's a lot of space between the grains. That's porosity. There's also space between the grains of the sand grains. That's porosity. There's a ton of space. So it's like a house of cards, right? There's a ton of space between grains when it's first deposited. And then what happens? You put a little bit of pressure on that. In other words, you put a little bit of overburden, some sand, some additional mud, whatever. And eventually there's enough pressure there to make it so these grains all collapse and organize themselves. And so now you have these layers, right? You have these layers, which is what we were seeing ultimately in this image. Right, all these layers, these are clay layers, right? Mud layers. And when it collapses like that, you lose a lot of space. You lose a lot of that porosity. And normally, inside that space, you're going to have water. Okay, and so when it collapses like this, these tend to expel a lot of water, release a lot of water. If anybody knows what liquefaction is, right, you've heard of that. This is where you have slope stability issues where people are building houses or building anything. And actually, we have quite a bit of this ongoing debate about liquefaction around the sort of industrial area north of Portland along the Willamette. You have a lot of areas along the Willamette River there where it's reclaimed land. So it's land where people just pushed a bunch of earth out there to create land and then built, industrial structures on them, like huge tanks that might hold oil and gas, for example. And they build these things and put on the reclaimed land. Well, that material that they built it on is going to have all sorts of different grain sizes associated with it, but there is going to definitely be some mud in there. And, you know, it hasn't had a chance, some of it hasn't had a chance to collapse down to this level, right? And so what liquefaction does is when you get some shaking there, you know, let's say that this thing, it's in this state up here, you get some shaking. Why would it shake? Well, maybe you have an earthquake, right? We're in an area of the world where we're prone to earthquakes. So maybe you have an earthquake, a little bit of shaking. Very typical situation, we're going to have some liquefaction. What that is as soon as it starts shaking, oh, that deck of cards is going to collapse. And what happens? Well, water is expelled, and now the whole thing is just like a big slurry, and you can get failure. And so that's one of the dangers, one of the risks, you know, really a hazard associated with building in those reclaimed areas, at least in the Pacific Northwest, where we have the potential for earthquakes. Okay, so back to clay. So we have all these grains, you know, they're going to collapse, create these layers, and then you can have water releasing. And notice that the porosity, so this is the amount of space within that sediment or within that sedimentary rock where you can put fluid or gas or something, the space between the grains. Okay, for a shale or a mudstone, it starts out with a really high porosity. This x-axis is porosity, so higher values on the right, lower values on the left. It starts with a very high porosity, and as it's buried, see, it loses that porosity very quickly because, again, these grains are going to sort of collapse, and now we have much less. So you go from very high to relatively low. Sand, on the other hand, it starts out with a porosity, and that porosity, you know, it does decrease, but it decreases much more modestly. It doesn't decrease nearly as quickly until you get down to this point here. We have an inflection. So I'm going, this is depth here on the y-axis, right? As this sediment gets buried, it's under more and more pressure, right? It's being compacted. And with the sand, you do have an inflection point, and that's related to cementation. So at some point, you may have precipitation of minerals between the grains, which is also going to reduce your porosity. So that can happen. That's what number three is. Okay, don't worry about that at the moment. But this is clay. This is mud. That's kind of how we see it. And, you know, if you went down to the molecular level, as we see here, you would have layers, and the layers take the form of, you know, this is how you get a lot of different clays. Different clays are unique in various respects in terms of whether you're looking at octahedral sheets, tetrahedral, and what the pattern is of going from one to another, etc. But ultimately, these are your sheets, okay? And what can happen is between your sheets, right, you can have a charged area that can hold on to water, hold on to it tightly. And so that's why, even though they can, mudstone as well, can hold a lot of fluid, it's got a lot of pore space, it can be oftentimes, depending on the clay, it can be very difficult to get that clay to release the water because it's actually bound there. It's bound there because of the charge, right? It sort of holds on to it. And that's, it's just a kind of unique and interesting aspect of mud and clay. And that's one reason why, you know, it's oftentimes hard for plants to grow in it, as we were seeing in the, you know, it's changing size, it's getting bigger and smaller, and it also doesn't want to release its water to the plants, to the roots. It's hard for the roots to get the water from the clay, to get it to release it. Okay, so let's go back to the kind of economic side now and start thinking about some of the different products, you know, that we might get from clays. And one of them is going to be something that's called kaolinite. Yeah, this is a nice picture of it. See, it's mud. If you were to look in there, it's a sedimentary rock, right? But the grains are really small. They're almost just like dust. Okay, it's not like a sand grain where you can see the grain, but there are still grains there. They're just really small. And this particular outcrop that you see here where it's being mined is in Georgia. You can see this darker layer in here. Okay, this guy is tertiary in age, so Cenozoic, which that might not mean much to you, but we're talking about tens of millions of years old. Okay, and then the stuff below it, this is a sandstone, actually, this lighter colored. Okay, so this is a larger grain size. This is Cretaceous in age, so, you know, probably between, you know, somewhere maybe around 100 million years, let's just say. That's in the Cretaceous. Okay, that's also when dinosaurs were wandering around. And then the white at the bottom here, that is where the kaolinite is being mined. Okay, they're stripping out the top here to get down to this kaolinite layer, which they want. And just sort of a fun fact, the reason why I kind of put it with a parenthesis here, kaolin is derived from a Chinese word, which is Gaoling. Sounds very different, right? But if you think of this would be Kaolin, sort of. We call it Kaolin at this point, so we've really changed the pronunciation. But it comes from a Chinese word known as Gaoling, which is a location in China, in Jiangxi province, which is going to be in the south. And it follows from this area because this was a famous area for porcelain creation, for the development of porcelain. I'm very well known for that. And they were using kaolinite ultimately to do that. And so that's actually where that name comes from, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, so this is one of the, just an example of how it might be mined, right? A lot of times it's going to be open pit like this. They just strip it out and start pulling it. Okay, so let's go a little bit closer to home here. This I mentioned from the Oregon map that we were going to look at Teague Mineral Products. So this is a place where we have some mining occurring. If you remember from the previous map, let's go back here just for a second. Okay, so we're over here, right? And in this case, we're looking at bentonite, okay? Bentonite, which is going to be another type of mud, very absorbent. I'm going to look at some of these in terms of what they actually do. I wonder if I can actually bring us to a... Yeah, here we go. Can we see this guy? So, let's close that out. Okay, so this is Teague. Let's see where we're at in space. I'm going back. This is similar to that Oregon map we're looking at, right? Okay, so here's Portland, way up here in the upper left. Okay, and I was coming down into this area here, right? Okay, let's zoom back in now. So I'm right at the Oregon-Idaho border, right? I think I was down here near Adrian. Yep, down on the 201. Was that right? Oh, I think I just passed it. There it is, on the Snake River. Look at that. Okay, and this is a bentonite mine, ultimately. And look at this. Here you go. Okay, they're mining into the subsurface here. Got a lot of bentonite, right? And this is ultimately going to be a mud that's highly absorbent, right? This is like most of the clays and such, maybe not all, but most of the clays in Oregon is going to be derived from this volcanic material. If I just kind of look around the area... Right, see all this white stuff? It's kind of outcropping here. You have it covered with soil in some places, some scrub, etc. Maybe some other rock types existing as well, this darker stuff. But you can see there is quite a bit of this lighter colored material. This is bentonite, okay? And that's what they're mining over there at that Teague mine, all right? So let's go back into full screen here. So that was Teague. And let's just look at clay for a second in terms of what are some of its uses. We're already talking about it, in terms of bentonite, right? Absorption. Okay, it has really good absorption properties, and that's because it can, certain clays at least can really hold on to water. It's used in kitty litter. I don't know if anybody recognizes Ren and Stimpy. That's back in my day. One of the cartoons from my day, but anyway, so it can absorb all sorts of things, oil for spills, for drilling, etc. Okay, it's used in some cases in paper, in the production of paper. Okay, and you can see this is kind of what's happening here. You have these different sheets. It helps to bond ultimately the paper fibers together, and then there's quite a few other ways that it's used here. Actually, I'm going to get rid of my image there just for a second so you can see this. There we go. So benefits of filter use, right? Okay, so, or filler use, I'm sorry. So this is in terms of paper, right, is that it reduces the cost because it's filler ultimately in some ways, right? It makes it brighter, and we're going to come back to color in a moment. It makes it more opaque, right, less translucent. Reduced energy in drying. There are some issues with friction that it helps to control. Changes the burn rate, which would be for use in cigarettes. So yeah, there's all sorts of reasons why clay is useful in paper. It's kind of fascinating. Okay, this one also is really important. And what are we looking at here? Well, this is a drill rig, right? We're drilling a well, okay, down in the subsurface. This could be a water well, it could be an oil and gas well, whatever. But either way, in drilling wells, okay, we use a lot of clay and a lot of mud generally. And actually, it's the main mining use of clay is for drilling, just because so much is used. So what is it used for? Why are we using it? Well, ultimately, when you're drilling a well, you can kind of see if we zoom in to the well bore here, expand that out, you can see you have your casing, which is ultimately your drill pipe. Okay, that comes down. And then you have the open hole, right, which is this thing here. And the pipe itself doesn't go right up to the edges of the hole, right? Your drill bit is down here, and it's actually making a bigger hole than the pipe fits into. So the pipe's a bit smaller than the hole, the open hole. And while it's drilling, while it's, you know, breaking up the rock down here with a bit, you're actually circulating fluid through that hole. So you're pumping mud down through the pipe, and then it gets to the bottom and comes out through the center of the drill bit, and then it circulates and it goes back up to where the drill rig is, right? It goes back up through what we call the annulus, okay, which is this area between the pipe and the formation and the rock. And why are we doing that? Well, the reason is because you're breaking up rock here. That rock's got to go somewhere. So the drilling mud, which is very precisely engineered in terms of density and all sorts of things, that mud is picking up what we call the cuttings. Okay, that's what's breaking up, and it's pulling those cuttings up through the annulus to the surface. And that also helps the driller. You know, you probably have a geologist, or you could have a well site geologist. You could have somebody sitting there at the, or it could be an engineer, somebody sitting there at the well site and watching these cuttings, these chunks of rock come up through the mud as drilling is happening. And they're looking at those cuttings and they're analyzing them and saying, oh, look, now we're in sandstone, now we're in mudstone, now we're in salt, whatever. And so those are actually helping the drillers know where they're at in the subsurface. What am I actually drilling into right now? Okay. The other thing that mud does, in addition to removing that material, the other thing it does is it controls pressure. Okay. We saw it in the last lecture, you saw a picture of the Macondo blowout, right? We were talking about how wells give you information about the subsurface. Some of our most important information about the earth comes from wells, okay? We also have accidents that occur when wells are being drilled, and the Macondo is a very famous one from 2010. It was a big oil spill. There were people that died. Oil spilled all over the place. I've mentioned this a couple times now, but ultimately, you have mud in the hole, okay, in order to hold back the fluid that's in the formation, okay? So we're going to get to this in groundwater, right? But in the formation here, and when I say formation, I mean the surrounding rock, right? In that rock, you have pore space, and there's fluid that's in that pore space, right? That fluid is under great pressure, especially when you get real deep, right? It's under great pressure. And so as soon as you intersect that formation and that fluid in the pore space with an open hole like this, okay, the pressure in the hole here is, if you didn't have any mud in it, at least it's going to be lower than the pressure in the formation. So that fluid is going to start flowing out of the formation into the hole and go right up towards the surface, okay, towards your actual rig here at the surface. Okay, and that's what happened with Macondo, right? They were in a section way, way deep down into the earth, right, 10,000 plus feet, and they came across a formation rock that had gas in the pore space, and they didn't have enough pressure in the hole here to hold that gas back. And so what happened is that gas started pushing out. It started pushing out and coming up the hole, and pretty soon the well was out of control. They couldn't hold that gas down, and what happens? You get a blowout. Right, the gas comes out the top, and it ignites something, and it's just an explosion, and it's just an open flame that's going everywhere, and oil and or gas is just spilling all over the place, and it's a catastrophe, right? So how do they keep that from happening? Well, the way they do it is they put mud in the hole, right? They're circulating that mud. That mud has a certain density, so it has a certain weight. And so it has a pressure that's associated with it, right? This pile of mud going all the way up to the surface. And the weight of that mud, and they literally call it mud weight, the weight of that mud is engineered very precisely to at least equal or exceed the fluid pressure in the surrounding rock so that that fluid doesn't start racing up the pipe and you don't get a blowout. Okay. There's more to it. And maybe I'll just mention briefly, the opposite problem, which you could also have, is what if you have too much weight in the hole? What if the mud you put down there is engineered, you put the density just a little bit too high, and so now the weight of the mud in the hole far exceeds or over is way too heavy for the formation fluid, okay, for the fluid that exists in the rock nearby. What's going to happen? Well, if the pressure in the hole here is much higher than it is in the formation, that mud's going to start flowing into the formation. Right? And they call this losses, experiencing losses. And so the way that they know that drillers know that is they're like, oh, wait, we're pumping mud down in the hole. Wait, we aren't getting as much back to the surface as we're pumping in. So that means it's going somewhere into the formation. It's going somewhere into the surrounding rock at depth, right? That's also a problem. It's also a problem because you need to have control of your well at all times to have safe operations. And there's a lot of engineering, a lot of science that goes into this stuff, but it's risky. It is risky business. You know, a lot of people, I may as well take this opportunity to mention fracking, because fracking, which is kind of a dirty word these days, but fracking ultimately is creating permeability in the subsurface, creating spaces for fluid to flow where you don't have much permeability. In other words, the rock is tight, so you can't flow fluid through that rock. So the idea behind fracking is, well, let's put it under high pressure and so that it fractures the rock and creates space for fluid to flow. Well, the way you do that simply is you just increase your mud weight, right? You just put denser and denser mud in the hole until the pressure of that mud, this pile of mud going all the way to the surface, the pressure is so high in the hole that it exceeds the strength of the rock, right? And so if it does that, if you put enough dense, heavy mud in your hole, you can exceed the strength of the rock. And what's going to happen? It's going to break the rock. It's going to fracture the rock and flow into the rock. That's literally what fracking is. So mud is used in any well. This could be a water well. It could be a well that you're drilling for, you know, an aquifer, whatever. Mud is used in any well that goes to any significant depth to control for pressure and also to remove materials that are coming out, right? The rocks that you're breaking up there at the bottom. So real fascinating. This is one of the primary uses, again, of clay. Okay, so let's continue on. There's a lot of other things that you can do with clay. And, I'll go ahead and turn myself back on here. Why not? Widespread applications in pharmaceuticals. So in the medical industry, clay is very important. Beauty industry as well, et cetera. But it's inert. It's low toxicity. It's in pharma, right? And what are some of those applications? Well, you can see down here, antacid, right? Tums is this is ultimately basically it's clay. Antibacterial, right? It doesn't, it doesn't host, it's relatively inert. So it ends up being good for that. Antidiarrheal, skin protectant as well. You know, you'd find clays in a lot of sunscreen as well. And then, active ingredients, we're talking about kaolinite, which we already mentioned. Talc, we're going to come to in a moment. And then gypsum, we're also going to mention in this lecture. Okay, we'll talk about those three. And it does all sorts of other things here, including in terms of being, these are sort of their properties, which are have found to be very useful. Okay. You know, we already mentioned that clays can come in a lot of different colors. We saw this in the Painted Hills of Oregon. You know, the other thing in John Day area is you're going to see also a lot of these greenish rocks that can be really beautiful, including in the Blue Basin. That's also clay. Okay, it's a different type of clay. Selatonite is the mineral that's coming out in there, making it blue. But in this case, right, we have all these different shades, sort of earth shades from red to tan to sort of lighter cream color. And a lot of the pigments, you know, that we get end up coming from clays because they can have such cool, interesting different colors. And those are shown kind of in this image as well. Okay, and I'll also mention, you know, I think I may have mentioned this briefly when I was doing my introduction. When I was a grad student, I was doing research in West China, and I was collecting mudstone to understand the tectonic, well, in other words, the growing of mountains in the area. So this is the Pamir Plateau and another mountain range called the Tian Shan, which is just north of the Himalaya and the Tibetan Plateau. I was collecting mudstones from layers of rock like you see here. Right, layers of rock. This is a picture I took from the field. So I'd walk along here and I'd collect samples of all these muds. This is primarily mudstone, a little bit of sandstone in here, but primarily mud. And I'd take that stuff back to the lab and I'd analyze it chemically. And that would tell me something about the climate of the area at the time that this stuff was deposited. And this is tens of millions of years ago. It'd also tell me something about what the mountains are doing in the surrounding area, which were my research questions. And I have this picture of this sort of villager hanging out here. This is the house I was staying in while I was doing that field work, and it was really funny. I would go out during the day and collect samples, you know, of mudstone primarily. And then I would come back home, you know, at night, and, you know, the family would always be like, oh, what'd you get today? They'd want to see what I had been up to. And, you know, I would bring back samples of this, and they were always like, what? Why do you care about that? It's mud. And I was like, yeah, it's not as exciting as like gems and rubies and stuff, but hey, there's a lot of really interesting information contained in the chemistry of these muds that's going to help us understand how these mountains formed around us, right? And what the climate was here in the past, et cetera. So yeah, I just wanted to give that shout. Clays and muds also very, very useful for research, right? For understanding our Earth, the history of the Earth, etc. Okay, so that's worth something. So where are these things forming, right? Where are we getting clays? Well, this is an image. Actually, it's from a geology field trip that I ran a couple years back. So these are PSU geology students. And it's the Alvord Desert. I don't know if anybody taking this class has been to the Alvord Desert. It is in Oregon. It's the very southeastern corner, so it's very far from Portland. It's a pretty remote area, but it's worth checking out if you're interested in getting out into a remote area and seeing some really cool desert landscapes. But this would be a playa, right? It's a dry lake bed. Okay, and so you see all these mud cracks here, right? This whole thing, I mean, you can drive out on it. It's very flat. This whole thing is a dry lake bed, right? And so what's cool about it is that, you know, all lakes ultimately have this same type of material at the bottom of them. Okay, they don't necessarily have mud cracks like this, but the sediment itself is this. It's mud. This is where you get mud deposited. You get them deposited in lake environments. The fancy word in geology for that is a lacustrine environment. And so you get all this mud that's deposited in a lake. It's very quiet. You know, it's generally deposited through suspension settling. And in this particular case, we can see it because the lake is dried out. So we can see what's there. And sure enough, it's a whole lot of mud. So this is a very typical place to get mud deposited. You can also get mud deposited on floodplains. Quite a bit is deposited there, like in the Willamette Valley. If you moved off to the sides, you know, where there's farms primarily, off to the sides from the main Willamette River channel, you would see there'd be a lot of mud out there, but it would be interbedded with sands and gravels. Okay. Lakes, on the other hand, are pretty much all mud. That's unless you're kind of near the edge of the lake where you can have some lake delta sediments coming in. But if you want mud, you go to an ancient lake. That's where you find it. Okay, so gypsum, I mentioned this just a little bit ago. What is gypsum? Well, it's ultimately an evaporite. Okay, and what does that mean? Well, when the lake is drying up, right, it's concentrating dissolved solids in that water that remains. And eventually, there's certain elements in there that are getting so concentrated that they're going to start precipitating out as minerals, and gypsum is one of those minerals. So the different minerals that precipitate out when they get concentrated like that, we call them evaporites. Gypsum, sodium chloride is one of them, is an evaporite, you know, in other words, halite. And there's a whole host of others. And we talked about in terms of lithium, right? We talked about this in lithium mining. That's also happening as these lakes are drying and concentrating into these brines. So gypsum is one of those evaporites that can come out. And this is a cross-section, ultimately looking at, you have these gypsum layers, right? These evaporite layers that exist along with just some mud here, and then another layer of gypsum, and then mud, and then gypsum. So very typical, again, in lake environments particularly that are evaporating, okay? There is a mine out in Empire, which is, this is in Nevada, right? I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Nomadland, but it actually deals with the gypsum mining in this area near Gerlach, Nevada, which is also coincidentally kind of near where Burning Man happens. But anyway, it's out in the middle of nowhere, and there is a gypsum mine out there where they're actually extracting that evaporite material, and they're creating drywall, okay? Gypsum is very, very useful in drywall. I might even have a link here. Let's see where this takes us. Oh, funny. Well, there's Burning Man. But let's go ahead and zoom out a little bit. So these are playa, right? These are dry lake beds. This is the Black Rock Desert right here. It's a playa. Okay, it's ultimately a dried out lake bed, right? Here's Gerlach. And then the gypsum mine. Here's Empire, right? The gypsum mine, which I don't think is active anymore. I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it quickly. Oh, this is cool, though. This dry lake bed looks really cool. Planet X Pottery. Wow. Yeah, this is the middle of nowhere. Well, I'll zoom out again here in a second, and so that you can see where we're just at generally in space. Okay, well, here's something happened. I don't know if this industry happens to be it, but ultimately these playa here, right? This is going to be pretty much mud out in the center here. There's a little bit of plants that are forming there. There's a little bit of irrigation that's happening out here as well. But yeah, that's what where a lot of that gypsum is going to be coming from, is going to be from these playa. And so where are we at in space? Well, we're out in the middle of nowhere in northwestern Nevada. So this is the border between Nevada, California, and Oregon. Just for reference, where we just were looking at the Alvord Desert with my two students there, that's this playa right here. Okay, we were out in this guy. And so, yes, this is Oregon, right? It's just a very far southeastern corner, Portland way up there. It's a long distance away. It's the opposite corner, right? Okay, well, let's head back to the slide deck here. So, yes, we're looking at the Empire Mining Company, made famous through Nomadland. Okay, onward. There are some other interesting evaporites that you can see, such as these. These are known as tufa towers. They're found at Mono Lake. We're going to be talking about Mono Lake a little bit more when we talk about water issues. But these are composed of calcium carbonate. So calcite, this is ultimately, you can consider it an evaporite as well, right? This is ultimately precipitating out of the water. And in this case, they happen where you have springs, where the springs are coming into the lake, and all of a sudden the chemistry changes. And so calcium carbonate precipitates out at that point. And forms these really beautiful tufa towers. These things are only exposed today because the lake levels come down. And again, we'll talk about that more when we talk about groundwater a little bit. Okay, and yeah, you do also have, this is a kind of a really cool one, right? This is a lake bed in Namibia. But yeah, ultimately mud down here. And, you know, it would have been a lake at one time, supposedly, but you have, you know, things can change, right? And you have some vegetation that existed at one point and no longer, right? Okay, so where else do we get muds, and where else might they be interesting? This kind of goes out from beyond the economic side of things, but this image here, I don't know if anybody knows where it comes from. This is actually a picture from Mars, okay, one of the rovers out there. And when you talk about NASA missions, you need geologists on these because ultimately you're looking at rocks. And, you know, if you look at this, notice that you have some stratigraphy, so layers of rock here. And notice how horizontal those are. It's sort of constant thickness, and it goes over long distances. Okay, a lot of people would look at this, and they might interpret it as being a lake deposit, a lacustrine deposit, right? So, you know, you probably have some muds out here if that's the case. They're going to be really old in the case of Mars, okay? But we also have that stuff out in Mars. We got mud. If we run out of mud on Earth, hey, we might have an option there, right? Okay, so let's look at a map of the world and where this stuff is coming from. It's pretty much everywhere. For the most part, you can see, you know, kaolin, which is kaolinite, bentonite. We looked at that as well. All sorts of other things, including diatomite, talc, which I also want to mention here in a moment. But you get this stuff all over the place. And these are some of the larger mines, more significant mines that are shown here. Like, we don't even have anything shown in Oregon, right? But we do also mine this stuff in Oregon. Okay, so I just mentioned it, talc. You also get talc that's being mined in Afghanistan. This is just an example. It's mined all over the place, but here's an example in Afghanistan. Again, this is a type of mud. And, you know, where it's that used, well, here's an example, Gold Bond, you know, this sort of powder. Over 95% of talc comes from open pit mines. You know, this is happening with a lot of the mud and clay. And this is just another example somewhere else in the world, right? Okay, so now let's think a little bit about soils. When we talk about soils, right, this is where a lot of the clays are forming, and it could be an ancient soil, which we call a paleosol, or it could be a modern soil. We can mine it from either, right? But a lot of times they end up being ancient soils. And so I show a typical soil profile here. You got the bedrock down below. That's breaking down, right? And then you have this zone of leaching, right? Well, let's start at the top, organic material. That's where all your vegetation is going to be. You can see this picture right here, okay? And then the zone of leaching and zone of accumulation, those two are really important, right? And look at what's happening here with depth, okay? Your soluble mineral material, right? And this is the abundance of that, okay? You get more, and then you get way less in the leaching zone, and then it goes way back up to being high in the zone of accumulation. Okay, so these ultimately you get water that's infiltrating into the soil profile, right, from precipitation. And that water is dissolving and mobilizing different minerals, okay, from the zone of leaching, and then it is leaving them behind in the zone of accumulation. This is a concentrating process. Okay, it's taking minerals that may be, you know, equally distributed throughout the soil. It's moving them from one area to another, concentrating them. You know, very important. This is going to be a theme, right? And so in the soil profile, you can see over here, this would be, you know, an area where you might focus your mining. If you were interested in finding at least certain minerals, you know, you could get clay throughout potentially. But that's sort of how this is working. And then we have laterites, right? And laterites are, you know, lots of different soil types out there. Laterites are used, you can see they're made, this is an industrial use. They're making bricks out of these. Okay, they're sort of chopping pieces and making chunks. Okay, and a laterite is ultimately going to be a soil enriched in iron, nickel, and aluminum. And so why is it red? Well, it's that iron. It's the iron that makes it red. And yeah, laterites can be useful for a lot of different reasons, building, right, being one of them. Okay, so let's look at a little bit of the vocabulary that's come about in this. Well, I'll just sort of mention it to you. We have talc. Okay, I want people to know what that is. Remember, this is something that we saw being mined in Afghanistan. This laterite here is going to be a soil that's enriched in iron. Evaporites, we talked about those quite a bit. Evaporites were going to be different minerals that form when you have a water body that's evaporating, concentrating those dissolved solids, and then these are precipitating out. And then a playa. Many of you may have already known what a playa is, but a playa is ultimately a dry lake bed, a lake environment where the water is completely dried out, so now the mud bottom is just exposed. Oftentimes, you're going to see mud cracks there. Okay, so that's what I want to say about mud, clay, etc. At the moment, hopefully, you know, you took out of this. There's a lot of uses. There's a lot of different types. We only talked about a few. This is, you know, we just don't have enough time, and we could do an entire class literally on mud. I don't know how many people would want to take that class. So yeah, we're just touching on things. But yeah, from here we're going to move into groundwater. Okay, we will come back to sort of industrial use sediments, specifically aggregate at some point, because aggregate's pretty interesting. It's just ultimately larger grain size, right? This has been all mud. We're going to go to a larger grain size, see how is that used, where is it mined, et cetera. That's going to come in a future lecture. But the next one, we're going to be talking about groundwater. So yeah, thanks.